From Washington, this is VOA News. The AU opens an investigation into atrocities in South Sudan. And at the Pistorius trial, a forensic analyst says the athlete may not have been wearing his prosthetics. I'm Frances Alonzo reporting from Washington. The head of a newly established commission of inquiry that will probe atrocities in South Sudan has pledged to leave no stone unturned as the panel investigates alleged human rights violations and other abuses. Former Nigerian President Olusegun Obasanjo spoke today shortly after the five-member African Union Commission was sworn in. Mr. Obasanjo said both Africans and non-Africans worldwide would be watching how his panel approached its work. He said the panel would work to prove that Africa has come of age and can manage its own issues. The panel will investigate atrocities that have occurred since an armed conflict erupted in mid-December. Meanwhile, East African leaders will meet in Ethiopia to discuss the size and mandate of a stabilization and protection force to be deployed in South Sudan. Martha Vanderwolf reports.
Heads of state of the East African bloc IGAD, which has been mediating talks between South Sudan's warring sides, are now turning attention to troop deployment. Ethiopian Foreign Ministry spokesperson Dina Mufti says the extraordinary summit is devoted just to South Sudan.
They'll be talking about the deployment of forces to the region, which most of them have agreed, because there is going to be a deployment of the African brigades from all IGAD countries plus two other non-IGAD members, Burundi and Rwanda.
Other countries that have said they are ready to send troops to South Sudan are Ethiopia, Kenya, and Djibouti. Marta van der Wolf, Addis Ababa.
A South African police forensics analyst says Oscar Pistorius was probably not wearing his prosthetic legs when he used a cricket bat to hit the door through which he fatally shot his girlfriend. It's an assertion that counters claims made by the athlete. In court testimony today, Johannes Vermeulen said he believes Pistorius was on his stumps when he used the bat to try to break open the door last year after fatally shooting Riva Stenkamp. Johannes Vermeulen demonstrated the angles used and said the marks were not consistent with Pistorius wearing his prosthetics.
As I said in my evidence in chief, the marks matched with in a natural position without the legs of Mr. Pistorius. That the marks is consistent with him being in a natural position without these prostheses.
You can read more details on this trial at voanews.com. Malaysia has again expanded the vast area where it's looking for the missing jetliner with 239 people on board, but acknowledges it's likely a search mission rather than a rescue effort. The transport minister, Hissamuddin Hussein, said today that ships and aircraft are now searching more than 90,000 square kilometers of water.
So many vessels and aircraft, so many countries to coordinate, and a vast area for us to search. And each time that passes, I fear that the search and rescue becomes just a search. But we will never give up hope. And this we owe to the families.
The minister at the news conference today said 42 ships and 39 aircraft from 12 countries are joining the search so far. The Boeing 777 aircraft disappeared from air traffic radar screens early Saturday. U.S. President Barack Obama is hosting Ukraine's prime minister at the White House today. It comes as a standoff between Russia and the West over the Ukrainian region of Crimea continues. This is President Obama's first meeting with the interim prime minister, Arseniy Yatsenyuk, and it's meant to underscore U.S. support for the new government and the Ukrainian people. As part of the talks, Mr. Yatsenyuk and President Obama will discuss financial assistance for Ukraine. The U.S. has already pledged $1 billion in aid. Hong Kong police say nine people have been arrested in connection with the vicious attack on a former newspaper editor. Kevin Lau received serious wounds to his torso and legs after being attacked last month by a man with a meat cleaver. The police commissioner said today that mainland authorities arrested two men, while Hong Kong police arrested seven others. You can read more details on this and more at voanews.com. I'm Frances Alonzo, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight,
East African leaders will meet in Ethiopia on Thursday to discuss the mandate and size of a stabilization and protection force to be deployed in South Sudan.
That's Marta van der Wolf reporting. We'll have full details on this story coming up. Also, Libya's former prime minister violates a travel ban and has left the country. A study considers women's food choices amid rising education and income levels. And a unique partnership works to prevent mother-to-child transmission of HIV/AIDS in Nigeria. We'll have these stories in the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young, music from Tanzania, and our feature reports. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, former Libyan Prime Minister Ali Zaidan has violated a travel ban and left the country. His departure came hours after the National Congress gave him a no-confidence vote. Malta State Radio reported Zaidan made a brief stop on the Mediterranean island before traveling on. His destination was not reported. The National Congress yesterday swore in Defense Minister Abdullah Al-Tini. The no-confidence vote came 2 hours after reports that a North Korea-flagged oil tanker carrying oil bought from rebels in the port of Al-Sidra eluded Libya's navy. Loss of the vessel was one of a series of disappointments for the interim government. Al-Tini will serve for 2 weeks while the divided assembly selects a replacement. The assembly has been deadlocked between Islamist and non-Islamic blocs, overriding a new constitution and establishing a date for national elections. East African leaders will meet in Ethiopia tomorrow to discuss the mandate and size of a stabilization and protection force to be deployed in South Sudan. Marta van der Wolf reports from Addis Ababa.
Heads of state of the East African bloc IGAD, which has been mediating talks between South Sudan's warring sides, are now turning attention to troop deployment. Ethiopian Foreign Ministry spokesperson Dina Mufti says the extraordinary summit is devoted just to South Sudan.
They'll be talking about the deployment of forces to the region, which most of them have agreed, because there is going to be a deployment of the African brigades from all IGAD countries plus two other non-IGAD members, Burundi and Rwanda.
Other countries that have said they are ready to send troops to South Sudan are Ethiopia, Kenya, and Djibouti. The presence of Ugandan troops in the country from the beginning of the conflict has led to criticism by the opposition side and the international community that they are an obstacle to a peaceful solution. So Uganda's troop will slowly be withdrawn. Fighting broke out in South Sudan mid-December after a dispute within the ruling SPLM. The dispute led to fighting between forces of President Salva Kiir and soldiers loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar. A January ceasefire hasn't taken hold, so regional leaders are determining how best to reinforce the truce. Dina Mufti says they're looking at how many troops will be needed and the extent of their mandate.
This is a kind of peacekeeping force, so they are going to reinforce or realize the cessation of hostility. They will help in that process. They will help the monitors and the people who verify the cessation of hostilities or the ceasefire.
After IGAD heads of state decide on the mandate and the size of the force, the African Union and the United Nations will need to give approval before the force can actually be deployed. The conflict in South Sudan has killed thousands of people and displaced close to a million. To ensure the participation of the South Sudanese people in the peace process, a civil society conference will be held in Addis Ababa after the IGAD summit. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
Coming up on 10 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Mali's National Assembly is expected to discuss the creation of a Truth, Justice and Reconciliation Commission this week. Human rights groups have expressed concern that the proposed commission will not have the necessary independence to make a difference. VOA's Anne Look has more from our West Africa Bureau.
New Mali is a work in progress. The crisis of 2012 and 2013 divided the country like never before, both literally and figuratively. A French-led military intervention may have physically reunited much of the country early last year, but communal divisions are far from healed. President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita says national reconciliation is a top priority. But first, Malians must figure out what exactly happened and why. This week, the National Assembly will debate the legal framework to create a commission to do just that. The proposed commission would have 3 years to explore crimes committed during this most recent crisis and during previous conflicts in the North. It would go back as far as independence in 1960. A previous commission created last year by the former interim government accomplished little. Its failings left Malians doubting the very idea. Human rights groups say this time the commission must be seen as impartial and representative. Attorney Mokhtar Mariko is head of the Malian Association for Human Rights. He says the mandate of the commission needs to be clearly spelled out, and the men and women who lead it cannot have been implicated in the crimes that were committed throughout the country. He says this commission must be truly independent. There is talk of attaching the commission to the relatively new Ministry of Reconciliation and Development for the North. Mariko says that's a bad idea, as it would open the commission up to political interference. The proposed commission would have 15 members and 7 working groups. International rights group Human Rights Watch says Malians should get a say in those appointed. The group says there should be a wide consultation with civil society, political parties, and other groups, along with public confirmation hearings. Human Rights Watch is also calling for the commission to have investigative powers that would allow it to refer cases to the criminal justice system and recommend reparations for victims. The proposed commission would be called the Truth, Justice, and Reconciliation Commission. Many Malians say that is exactly the order in which things must happen for this initiative to succeed. Truth, justice, then reconciliation. Anne Luk, VOA News, Dakar.
In many middle and low-income countries, obesity levels rise along with income, but a new study says the better educated women are, the better their chances of avoiding obesity. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Dr. Amina Etsy-Selmi is the lead author of the University College London study. She wanted to know if trends in high-income countries could be found elsewhere.
We know that in high-income countries, education and income tend to go together, and that those who are most educated and have the highest income tend to be thinnest, and the opposite being true.
The study looked at the middle-income countries of Egypt, Jordan, and Colombia, and the low-income countries of Nigeria, India, and Benin. These are countries where income levels are on the rise. As a result, women are buying higher-calorie foods. Researchers call them energy-dense foods. Simply put, they can pack on the pounds because they're often laden with sugar, salt, and fat. These can be processed foods or so-called fast foods.
The study shows that although higher income or higher wealth seems to be correlated with a greater risk of obesity in women in middle-income countries and low-income countries as well, in middle-income countries, something strange happened in that education seemed to start protecting against this effect, so that women with higher education weren't affected by this wealth effect that made other women more obese.
She says there may be a few explanations for this.
It could be that more educated women just have different body shape preferences. They're more in contact with Western images of beauty, which promote thinness. It could also be that they have better health understanding, different time preferences, so they kind of invest in future health.
But the link between education, wealth, and health appears a bit different in low-income countries. It may have to do with past economic conditions, when many types of high-calorie foods were scarce. The desire for those foods now may outweigh the protective education effect seen in middle and high-income countries.
The greater scarcity means that obesity is just not an issue in that kind of environment. Any advantage you might have socioeconomically, whether it's higher education or higher wealth, might be used to be able to access a greater quantity of food. and the market isn't as complex as a middle-income country where you have lots of products and there are lots of decisions to be made, and that's where education may start to kick in as something that helps consumers to make decisions.
Also, low-income countries may not have public health systems in place to deal with growing obesity levels. Obesity has been linked to such non-communicable diseases as cancer, diabetes, and cardiovascular disease. Dr. Aitzi Selmi says more study is needed on what she calls the interplay between education and the wider environment.
Interventions could target either the education side of things to encourage women's education or health knowledge. I mean, we need to look in more detail on the pathways that link education to obesity. Or it could be to do with the general environment and the kind of information that is in the environment, and that in some ways puts those who don't have education at a disadvantage because the signals that are coming from the environment might promote unhealthy behaviors like overconsumption.
That environmental information may include multimedia advertisements, which tell consumers fast food is delicious, cheap, and easy to get. They often lack details on the food's nutritional value. She says education can be a good defense against unhealthy food choices.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. If you understand the risks that are around you and how your decisions affect your health, then you'll probably make different decisions.
Aitzi Selmi is a Wellcome Trust Fellow at University College London. The study appears in PLOS ONE. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
A South African police forensics analyst says Oscar Pistorius was probably not wearing his prosthetic legs when he used a cricket bat to hit the door through which he fatally shot his girlfriend, an assertion that counters claims made by the athlete. In court testimony today, Johan Vermeulen said he believes Pistorius was on his stumps when he used the bat to try to break open the door last year after fatally shooting Reva Steenkamp. The door was set up in the courtroom as Vermeulen described how marks on the bat matched one smaller and one larger hole in the door. Pistorius said in an affidavit during a bail hearing last year that he had put on the prosthetics prior to hitting the door with a cricket bat. His lawyer, in cross-examining Vermeulen, said the defense team could show the same marks can be made by someone in a standing position. You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. At 18 minutes past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Libya's former prime minister violates a travel ban and has left the country. East African leaders will meet in Ethiopia tomorrow to discuss the mandate and size of a stabilization and protection force to be deployed in South Sudan. And a study considers women's food choices amid rising education and income levels. And of course, we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight. Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest, Washington, D.C., 20237. Well, South Africa's Johannesburg is chatty and concise. According to a new study, the city's metro area averages one geo-tagged tweet every 13 seconds, leading the African continent in Twitter usage. Using 140 characters or less, users in the metro area posted 608,387 geotagged tweets over a three-month span, the study found. Peter Cox reports from Johannesburg on the tweeting trends of Africa.
It's not a huge surprise that Johannesburg sends out tweets more frequently than any other city in Africa. That's what the How Africa Tweets survey from Portland Communications found after looking at Twitter statistics from October to December in 2013. Johannesburg is an economic leader in Africa, and South Africa has the highest smartphone penetration of any nation on the continent. Alan Kamau heads the Nairobi office for Portland Communications.
Also, Egypt featured highly. Cairo, Alexandria, other top cities in terms of active tweeting. Moving to East Africa, Nairobi is the most active, not surprising. It's sixth most active on the continent.
The study was conducted by sorting through all geotagged Twitter posts. That means that a user allows their device to show their location or puts location information into their tweet. So these numbers don't necessarily reflect the total amount of tweets out of each city. But Kamau says they do give a reliable estimate for the amount of Twitter usage.
It should be a broad indicator of, you know, the trends within the Twitter sphere. It's representative enough for it to be a broad kind of indicator of Twitter activity, trends in terms of how people are using it.
The company has done the survey twice now, and Kamau said the largest change he's seen is how Twitter is being used.
In terms of topics, one of the shifts that we've seen is, you know, when we looked at our survey in 2012, that it was very much social conversations online. We're seeing much more corporate, so many more companies having a presence online. So brands having a greater share of voice, being more active, engaging consumers directly.
He said consumers are also using Twitter to air out issues with bad products or services, not only with companies, but government as well.
It's a much more public place, and also it's a direct channel, you know, it's a direct and public channel to complain, and people organize very well, as you know, on social media.
Kamau says companies, governments, and organizations, even sports teams, see great potential in marketplace engagement. The top topic of Twitter across the continent is football.
Africans love football, are very passionate about their football teams, and, you know, Twitter provides a platform, again, for fans to get behind their team. So, you know, the most mentioned football team is Johannesburg's Orlando Pirates. And I think, you know, it's just a fantastic platform for that kind of thing.
Mickey Modisane, public relations director for the Orlando Pirates, agrees. The team's Twitter handle has 145,000 followers and is used frequently.
Sometimes we tweet close to about 15 to 20 times in a day. With regard to, it could be about players' availability ahead of the match, ticket sales, PR activities, PR campaigns.
He's happy that his team is one of the most talked about teams on Twitter.
For us, we're quite excited. It simply means there's something good that we're doing as far as social network is concerned, you know, and as far as Twitter is concerned, because we definitely engage our fans.
That might be something to tweet about. Peter Cox for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Thank you, Peter. Well, prevention of mother-to-child transmission of HIV/AIDS, also known as PMTCT, is the goal of a unique partnership in Nigeria, where nearly 70,000 babies are born with the illness every year. The global oil company Chevron has partnered with local nonprofit organizations in Bayelsa State to generate pilot programs that address prevention of mother-to-child transmission of HIV/AIDS. The company says prevention is the key to realizing an AIDS-free generation. Deji Hastrup is General Manager of Policy, Government and Public Affairs of Chevron Nigeria Limited. He spoke with me about how their partnering with the local community is proving successful and helping to prevent the spread of HIV/AIDS.
We've been committed to the PMTCT program, that's prevention of mother-to-child transmission of HIV. In 2011, we pledged $20 million to the UN's mission to eliminate the mother-to-child transmission of HIV by 2015. Since that time, we surpassed our original pledge by committing $26.1 million to programs and partnerships with PACT, the Business Leadership Council, that's BLC, and the Global Fund. And this will help to eliminate vertical transmission of HIV in Angola, Nigeria, and South Africa. And in all these countries, we have substantial presence.
How were you able to mobilize people on the ground to get this program going?
Our partner in this venture is PACT. PACT has tried and tested experience in regards to mobilizing local communities, and so we're very proud of the partnership we've been able to forge with PACT. The Bayelsa State Ministry of Health is also involved in this, and also the Bayelsa State Action Committee on AIDS, which is known locally here as BACA. These grassroots involvement in projects such as this ensures stakeholder buy-in right from the start, and a very high likelihood of project success, and more importantly, the sustainability.
Looking at the success of this program, what have been the results of doing this?
In the first year, PROMO have achieved remarkable results. First of all, four community-based organizations have been trained to support the prevention of mother-to-child transmission outreach. This is important, as I said, for sustainability. 148 local health workers have received close to 6,000 hours of training through this project. About 6,500 individuals have been reached throughout Bayelsa State, and more than 7,000 women have been tested for HIV during antenatal care. About 700 people currently receive HIV counseling. These are substantial results.
In looking at how you are reaching people, such as the outreach aspect of it, how are you getting to people in remote areas? Are the clinics actually set up there, or how do people reach the clinics so that they can get the health care that they need?
There are clinics that treat pregnant women that are already there. It's just the aspect of educating people, helping them to understand the need to get tested early, and if they test positive, how to prevent transmission to the unborn child. That's the challenge that we face. Of course, this is a little bit of a challenging area. It's a very remote terrain where most of the settlements, communities and villages are in swampy areas. But this is an area that PACTIS is quite familiar with, and they're working, as I said, with local community-based organizations to reach those who need to be reached.
I understand that mobile technology has also played a key role in the success of this program. So how has that helped?
The rollout of the mobile phone data collection is a reminder system that PACT has developed as part of the PROMOTE project. It provides health education messaging by texting SMS messages through mobile phones. It also tracks women and infant pairs. It provides reminders on timely attendance at antenatal care, which is something that you have to remind those in these rural communities about. It also shares the protocol for safe delivery and exclusive breastfeeding practices. These are all done through the mobile phone applications that have been put in place. It's really helping.
What are your goals for this year, and are there any other countries that you are looking at to do this work?
Currently, the prevalence of HIV in this part of the country is such that we have enough on our hands currently. And so what we're hoping to do is to scale up and deepen the successes that has already been accomplished. We want to be sure that this program is sustainable. And a major focus of PROMOTE is to reduce the stigma that surrounds HIV/AIDS, both at the health facility level and at the community level.
Hello, I'm Linor Moudou. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.
What's happening, Africa? This is Jackson Bungani in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Nadia Sami in Johannesburg, South Africa. Thank you for joining us on Upfront each Wednesday, 17:30 UTC, for a lively discussion on issues that are topical, challenging, and always engaging.
The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Ooh, without my family, I don't think I would have been here today because they gave me a lot of support morally.
Can't AU, African Union, can't these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this whatever?
Employment rates are climbing, so definitely there's less jobs in the market now.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Libya's former prime minister violates a travel ban and has left the country. East African leaders will meet in Ethiopia tomorrow to discuss the mandate and size of a stabilization and protection force to be deployed in South Sudan. And a study considers women's food choices amid rising education and income levels. Coming up, we'll have music from Tanzania and our feature reports. I'm Kim Lewis, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And, of course, it's time now for the sunny side of sports with Sonny Young. And happy Wednesday, Sonny.
Happy Wednesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sonny, it looks like you'll be opening your mailbag this evening.
Kim, let's open the sunny side of sports mailbag for some sportylicious feedback from our Voice of America listeners. William Mensah sent me a nice letter from Accra, Ghana. William says he's greatly enjoying the 2014 Voice of America calendar, which has a theme this year of American presidents. And just in case you're wondering, the late president, John F. Kennedy, is featured for the month of March, and our current president, Barack Obama, is featured in December. William also sent me a nice personal photo of him in his Accra Marathon running outfit. I showed the photo at our Wednesday morning staff meeting here at VOA headquarters. And one of my VOA colleagues asked, "Sonny, how old is William?" My response, "William is ageless." Getting back to the VOA calendar, if you'd like one, please send an email requesting one to askvoa@voanews.com. Once again, that address, askvoa@voanews.com. Supplies are limited, so get your request in soon. I've also had some response to my latest Sunny Side of Sports blog post titled "Ayanle Suleiman Earns Athletic Glory for Djibouti." I write about the 21-year-old athlete who won a gold medal in the men's 1500 meters at the recent World Indoor Championships in Poland. Yasser Bolo, no address given, sent me a short message in French. And my rough English translation is, "The people of Djibouti gather together and say bravo, Ayanle." Our Nightline Africa sportsman in Lagos, Shagun Dot on the spot, Adeyemi, also sent me a short email from Nigeria's commercial capital. And Shagun writes, "Ayanle is definitely a trailblazer. I haven't heard much about him until this good profile, Sonny. Africa will be looking up to him for a medal at the 2016 Olympics in Brazil." Our VOA listeners can read my blog post by going to voanews.com, and then on the right side of the page, you'll see a header titled "Blogs at VOA News."
Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone. Subscribe to VOA Newsfeed. VOANews.com.
African football guru David Legg has been taking a look at the recent action in the CAF Champions League and the CAF Confederation Cup club competitions. David, how about the results in the Confed Cup?
Yes, Sonny, once again, it was first round, second leg results, this time CAF Confederation Cup. Etoile Sahel of Tunisia 3, CARA of Congo 0, Etoile qualified 3-1. AFC Leopards of Kenya 2, Supersport United of South Africa 2, Supersport qualify 4-2. Al Ahly Shendi of Sudan 1, AS Kigali of Rwanda 0. Kigali win 5-4 on penalties after a 1-1 tie. El Jadida of Morocco 4, Gamtel of Gambia 0, Jadida win 6-0. Maghreb Fez of Morocco 2, Mediama of Ghana 1, Mediama win 4-2. Zesco United of Zambia 1, Ferroviario Beira of Mozambique 0. Zesco win 1-0. St. Michel United of the Seychelles 3, Hau Mine of Zimbabwe 1. Hau Mine win 6-4. Bayelsa United of Nigeria 2, Konzo of Congo 0. Bayelsa win 2-0. CS Constantine of Algeria 2, Red Lions of Liberia 0. Constantine win 3-0. ASEC of Ivory Coast 1, Bamako of Mali 1. ASEC win 3-1. Ishmaelia of Egypt 0, Etanchieti of DR Congo 0. Ishmaelia win 4-3 on penalties after a 0-0 tie. Petro Atletico of Angola 4, Ebuasa Dwarfs of Ghana 0. Petro win 4-2. Wadi Degla of Egypt 2, Douanes of Togo 0. Degla win 3-1. Djoliba of Mali 1, Don Bosco of DR Congo 0. Djoliba win on away goals after a 2-2 tie. Wari Wolves of Nigeria 1, Union Douala of Cameroon 1. Wolves win 4-3. And lastly, CA Bezerton of Tunisia 2, Desportiva Huela of Angola 0. Bezerton win 3-0 on aggregate.
David, with the completion of the first round proper in the Confederation Cup, which teams are the surprise ones, in your opinion?
Well, Sonny, a number of upsets so far. One is certainly Medeama of Ghana. They've done very well indeed to knock out Maghreb Fez. Now, Maghreb Fez in 2011 won the Confederation Cup, and they certainly would have fancied their chances against one of the lesser Ghanaian sides. But Medeama built a very solid foundation in the first leg by winning 3-0 at home. And although they lost 2-1 in the second leg, they were comfortable 4-2 winners on aggregate. Interesting background to this tie, Sonny. Medeama were so worried about dirty tricks. And dirty tricks, unfortunately, are pretty common in African football. It can involve the keys going missing to the training ground. It can mean that players being harassed by prostitutes around midnight. It can mean that all of a sudden the water and electricity at the hotel are deliberately cut off. And another favorite ploy of teams seeking a psychological advantage is to arrive about 3 or 4 hours late at the airport to pick up the visiting team. So what Medeama did is they took, among other things, their own food and water with them. But I'm happy to report that everything went well for the Ghanaians in Morocco, and they're now through to the last 16 stage. Unfortunately, their compatriots, Ebuasi Dwarfs, who were also bidding for a place in the last 16, they came horribly unstuck, Sonny, in Angola against Petro Atletico. Two up from the first leg, the Dwarfs were hammered 4-0. And a couple of names that some of our older listeners will recall, I think, with some glee, like Flavio and Gilberto. Now, they were two Angolans who played for Al Ahly a few years ago and did very well indeed. Flavio scored two goals for the Angolans, and Gilberto scored one, and the other came from the Senegalese Keita. The Dwarfs were still leading until the 73rd minute. They were one behind on the day, but 2-1 ahead on aggregate. And then bang, 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 three goals in quick succession sunk the Ghanaians. So mixed look for the Ghanaians there, Sonny. But better news for the Nigerians after their dismal performances in the Champions League when Enyimba and Kano Pillars already out of it. Better luck in the Confederation Cup with Wari Wolves and Bayelsa United qualifying in contrasting fashion. Wolves had beaten Union Douala of Cameroon 3-2 away, so they would have fancied their chances of another victory at home. But they had to settle for a draw in a match of two penalties. Najare, after 55 minutes, gave the Wolves the lead. And then Christian, in the 90th minute, equalized for Union Douala, but the Wolves safely through 4-3 on aggregate. A more straightforward success for Bayelsa United from the Delta State. They scored once in each half to see off Konzo from Congo Brazzaville 2-0 and also 2-0 on aggregate after a goalless first leg. The hopes of Kenya rested on AFC Leopards. Now, they were two down after their first match against SuperSport United in South Africa, but when James Satuma scored after 48 minutes of the second leg in Nairobi, the Kenyans must have thought that they had a chance of seeing their club go through. But unfortunately, the joy only lasted for 5 minutes before Pala equalized for the South Africans. Duty put the South Africans ahead, and then right on the final whistle, Wanga with a far post header equalized for Leopards. So 2-2 on the day, but unfortunately for Leopards, it was 4-2 for SuperSport on aggregate.
And David, who are the leading scorers now in the Confederation Cup?
Well, Masharu from How Mine of Zimbabwe, still the leading scorer, Sammy, got another goal at the weekend, so he's now up to 6, and it's just as well because hot on his heels, Fenosoa of St. Michel United of the Seychelles, and Nana from Al Jadida of Morocco. Now, he scored 2 goals away against Gamtel of Gambia, and another 3 at the weekend, so he scored 5 goals in that one tie. So those two players on 5 goals. And then on 3, you've got the Senegalese Keita from Petro Atletico of Angola. You've got Maman Niang, the Senegalese, who's playing for SuperSport in South Africa. And you've got Wanga from AFC Leopards. So an interesting test coming up here, Sonny, with Masharu, the pace setter, with 6 goals.
Looking ahead, David, what does the second round draw look like in the Confederation Cup?
We start, Sonny, it's at 12 Sahel of Tunisia against SuperSport United of South Africa. Now, at 12 Sahel, as I've said many times on the Sunny Side of Sport, have a unique place in African football. They're the only club to have won every available title. That's the Champions League, the Confederation Cup, the Super Cup, and 2 now defunct competitions, the African Cup Winners' Cup and the CAF Cup. They were discontinued after 2003 and replaced by the Confederations Cup. So a tough test there for SuperSport United. Then you've got Kigali of Rwanda against Jadida of Morocco, Medeama of Ghana against Zesco United of Zambia, How Mine of Zimbabwe against Bayelsa United of Nigeria, Constantine of Algeria against ASEC of Ivory Coast, Ismailia of Egypt against Petro Atletico of Angola, Wadi Degla of Egypt against Djoliba of Mali, and the Wari Wolves of Nigeria. They've got a tough one. They're up against CA Bezerton of Tunisia, who reached the semi-finals of the Confederation Cup last year. Same date, Sonny, as in the Champions League. First legs, March 21, 22, and 23, with the return matches on March 28, 29, and 30. And those 8 winners, they will qualify to play the CAF Champions League second round losers. And the winners of those ties will go through to the group stage.
Thanks, David. That's our African football guru, David Legg, speaking with us once again from Johannesburg, South Africa. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny, and listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 17:30 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America. Well, coming up in part 3 of our series on China in Africa, is the Chinese dream costing local jobs? And the toll the fighting in South Sudan is taking on its children. First, some music. Here's Uganda featuring Desire with Amwami. Amwami, that's Uganda, featuring Desire. Well, as China builds soft power throughout Africa, the Chinese dream is being tentatively and unofficially touted on the continent. China is now Africa's largest trading partner, and much of its investment includes deals to build infrastructure. But some critics say Chinese companies too often bring their own workers at the cost of local jobs. In part three of her series, Ricky Shryock looks at how the Chinese dream and an effort to increase China's soft power is playing out in Africa.
The price of Chinese-made shoes has doubled over the past few years in Dakar's markets, according to vendors. As a Senegalese businessman working with Chinese partners for more than a decade, Mustafa Pai has gradually seen the imports of these shoes arrive at the port in Senegal's capital, and he distinctly remembers why the price increased.
Quand les gens venaient d'arriver, bon, ils avaient commencé à inonder le marché. Bon, ceux qui fabriquaient les jars là, comme vous dites, les artisans.
When the shoes that were made in China began arriving, that hurt business for Senegalese shoemakers, he said, and they took that up with the government, which then taxed the Chinese-made shoes, and the prices went up. Today, China is Africa's largest trading partner, but the influx of Chinese products has sped up the decline in Africa's industrialization since the 1980s. The continent's textile industry lost 750,000 jobs over the last decade, according to Reuters news agency, which cites the Johannesburg-based Brenthurst Foundation. Sven Grimm, director of the Center for Chinese Studies at Stellenbosch University in South Africa, says this poses a problem for China's recent effort to promote the idea of a Chinese dream in Africa. This effort to increase China's soft power touts that the regions share goals of economic prosperity, he says.
I think that's one of the challenges in the relationship, a Chinese mass production that just swamps the market.
Pai adds that even when China invests to build infrastructure in Africa, issues arise.
Le seul problème qu'on a avec les Chinois, c'est qu'ils viennent avec leur main d'œuvre. C'est ça ce qui pose problème. Voilà. Si les entreprises qui sont là emploient des Sénégalais, hein, pour la construction, par exemple, des infrastructures, ce serait intéressant.
The only problem we have with the Chinese, he says, is they come with their own workers. It's that that poses a problem. If the businesses that are here would employ Senegalese for construction work, for example, that would be interesting. A change in that business model could help China's image. One place that relationship is evolving is Ethiopia. In the early 2000s, Chinese-made shoes threatened the country's traditional leather sector.
For Ethiopia, which has a leather industry and a shoe industry, or had one, that was a major challenge to have cheaper Chinese products.
Today, Ethiopia's shoe industry has adapted and Chinese owners are now opening shops in the country. Chinese shoe manufacturer the Huan Group is planning to expand their operations near Addis Ababa to create tens of thousands of jobs. This shift from Chinese business owners could also benefit them in another arena, evading a Made in China label. African consumers often confront the tag with a negative attitude.
There is a certain wariness, and I mean, there's anecdotes that you can hear of people, even illiterate people, looking for the C shape somewhere on the product and then thinking twice whether to buy it or not.
According to Reuters, on a large scale, Beijing has provided capital to a continent in need of investment. The China Import-Export Bank is Africa's largest creditor, and Beijing has promised $20 billion more in loans over the next 3 years. Ricky Shryock for VOA News, Dakar.
And for more on our feature series, log on to our website at www.voaafrica.com. Officials say South Sudan's fighting is difficult for everyone to handle, but it is especially hard on children. They say children need special attention as they try to cope with the impact, but there just aren't enough resources. Mugumi Davis Wakaringi has the story from Juba.
5, 6, 7.
About a dozen children gathered on the outskirts of Juba to play football. Adults were present, but 13-year-old Rejoice Wasuk says he's still scared to be outdoors.
When I'm walking outside there, I will remember that they will come and shoot us. When even I saw it, someone who going with the gun, I will say that she will come, he will come to shoot me, so I fear to go in the road.
Wasuk is one of the 40 orphans who live at Confident Children Out of Conflict, OCCC. She says when fighting broke out in mid-December in Juba, she had gunfire for 3 straight days. She says she was convinced someone was coming to kill her.
The small children, even us, were united in the corridor. Even when we are here, we all come together here. We start to pray and we are crying.
11-year-old Kakule Helen says every time she hears anything that sounds like a gunshot, she hides.
I'm here, the gun, I'm here, the gun is here. Then I'm run from here, I'm not bed, I'm not eat, I'm go under the bed, I'm cutting with my blanket down there.
Kathy Grenadai, who runs CCC, says Wasuk and Kakule are not the only children having problems. She says more than 2 months since the fighting ended in Juba, she still has a hard time convincing the children they are safe.
They don't go, like, outside to the market where they used to go before. They stay within the compound, and they talk to each other not to move up and down. Sometimes if they hear any sporadic shooting, it reminds them of that day.
Don Potter, the chief of strategic communications for the UN Children's Fund in South Sudan, says children witnessed many acts of brutality during the fighting.
Children have been killed, of course. Children have been hurt, injured, attacked, orphaned. They've lost some of, many of them have seen their parents killed in front of their eyes or seen relatives killed, seen friends, neighbours. It's been devastating for many, many children.
The UN estimates that more than half of the 700,000 displaced people in South Sudan are children. Potter says children need special attention to help them recover from trauma. But South Sudan does not have trained psychologists and other specialists needed to help each traumatized child recover. Still, they do what they can.
What we have done in the two UNMISS camps in Juba, for example, temporarily we've set up what we call child-friendly spaces where young children can go and play and sing and do some basic learning. And then we're also temporarily using those also as classrooms for older children.
CCC's Grenadai says she hopes services can be extended outside the camp because all children who experienced what happened in this country need support. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Ruakarinj in Juba.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Jackson Mbunganyi, and our engineer, Joe Gill, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In late February, the U.S. Department of State released its annual country reports on human rights practices. The report, which covers almost 200 distinct countries and territories worldwide, is mandated by the U.S. Congress. The Human Rights Report is not just some high-minded exercise, said Secretary of State John Kerry. This is the most comprehensive, authoritative, dispassionate, and factual review of the state of human rights globally. A number of clear negative trends continued in 2013, specifically the tightening of restrictions on private citizens and civil society as a means of stifling dissent. Governments in every region of the world continued to restrict citizens' universal rights to exercise freedoms of assembly and association. They passed new legislation to silence political dissent and used excessive force to crack down on civil society and peaceful protest. Many governments continued to restrict free expression, online and off, targeting journalists and media outlets to control or eliminate political criticism and opposition. Members of security forces unlawfully arrested, raped, tortured, and killed protesters and dissidents, frequently with impunity, as governments refused to make them accountable for their acts. A number of governments failed to protect their citizens from exploitation, ignoring deplorable and unsafe working conditions, leading to injury and deaths. Workers' attempts to organize and bargain collectively were frequently impeded by governments' failure to enforce labor protections, as well as government interference in their activities and violence and threats against labor leaders. And finally, governments subjected members of marginalized groups, such as religious and ethnic minorities, women and children, LGBT persons and persons with disabilities, to repressive policies, societal intolerance, discriminatory laws, and disenfranchisement, and failed to hold accountable those who committed crimes against them. The United States of America will continue to speak out without a hint of arrogance or apology on behalf of people who stand up for their universal rights, said Secretary of State Kerry.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.